it, you have to really read it, Dick. It's called Controlled Theta Radiation, where he took one of his G5RV type of design. Remember, the G5RV was all designed with open wire feeders. It was only into, you know, more modern era, because he came up with that design way back before the days of coax. And his design, original design, was with open wire feeders until modern days, like I say, when they took a way of getting the coax onto the situation by sticking that matching network up there, you know, some part of the, after the feeders come down to, the open wire feeders come down to this matching network that then continues with coax. But he wrote a very interesting, another concept called, did you ever happen to read it, called Controlled Theta Radiation, over?
No, I haven't read that one, Mel. Why don't you give us a little bit of a synopsis of what it seems to be saying? And it's interesting that the 300 ohm open wire line, or the twin lead line, which is part of his Louvarney antenna, the case, the G5RV, I think you're saying the coax that feeds the open wire line section is a modern day embodiment, that the original antenna was open wire line all the way back to the shack. And by the way, properly used open wire line can intentionally be a radiator. And so as long as you've designed it in the antenna, and so that the, what you call the antenna does some of the radiation, and the feed line, when it's laid out correctly, also does some of the radiation, there's nothing wrong with that, as long as that feed line is not going by your neighbor's television set and bombing the daylights out of it in your particular apartment building. So the closest, I mean, the main reason we put up an antenna with its transmission line is to do radiating. In certain circumstances, radiating at the transmission line might be okay, but you want to be a little bit careful with that, otherwise you could have some RF in the shack where the D104 microphone will bite your lip when you come close to it. Go right ahead back to you, Mel, K2KEY, K2LIW.
Okay, the controlled theta radiation, remember, on G5RV was fed with 450 ohm open wire feeders, which it still is marketed today, except I can say for the updating of it. But the original design was strictly straightforward with that 450 ohm open wire feeders. What he did, I don't remember it exactly. I remember he said some kind of a changing in the performance of the antenna to actually favor another direction, so he couldn't swing it, couldn't move it another direction. I don't remember how he actually phrased it. He said he could control the bulb on the antenna to some extent by on the feed line. He would split it somewhere. One wire, he'd split it and stick in another piece of 450 ohm wire, if I remember correctly. Some configuration. Like I say, it's very foggy in my mind at this point. A lot of things get foggy these days. I think our age is beginning to show, because I used to be able to recall all the things in detail. But that was the essential part of it, in which he called it. I'd have to find it again. Called control feeder radiation, and by G5RV. I'm going to have to find it, Dick, to get any further info on it. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Mel. Good information. Lots and lots of ways of building an antenna. You take any guy that just came out of a respected college with a bachelor degree in his hand for electrical engineering, a good four-year college, and I've done this on many occasions, particularly when I'm interviewing a future potential employee of some of the companies I work for, like Airborne Instruments Laboratory, and I was doing some of the interviews, and you interview a recent grad, and you ask him, okay, antennas are kind of important, how many kinds of antennas do you think there are? I've asked quite a few of the applicants that, not as a real question with reference to the application, but because I just wanted to know how the schools are doing. And in many cases, you get answers like, oh, there's about 15 or 20 kinds of antennas. You open up any one one of the four issues of the Antenna Engineering Handbook by McGraw-Hill, any one of the four editions, you'll rapidly come to the conclusion there's approximately 5,000 kinds of antennas, and I'm not kidding. Now, maybe some people will group them together a little bit differently than I do, and maybe they think there's 3,725, or maybe 6,620. Doesn't matter. It's in that order. And the average electronic engineer comes out of the school, the average electronic engineer, with the opinion that there's a very small number. So, and new ones are being invented all the time. My name is on 22 patent applications for antennas over the last 7 or 8 years in particular. And some of those have become commercial products that are being manufactured and sold as part of other products, mostly handheld. My forte these days is designing small handheld antennas for UHF frequencies with moderately high performance. And when I say moderately high performance, I'm talking about antennas with 3% bandwidth, where the standing wave ratio does not exceed 1.1 to 1. In other words, 25 or so, or as much as 30 decibels of reflection coefficient out of the antenna with a 3% bandwidth on a UHF frequency. You go to any normal antenna manufacturer. Let me drop. You go to any antenna manufacturer and you tell him you would like him to build you an antenna. Let me drop. You like him to build you an antenna with 1.1 maximum standing wave ratio. And he would basically say to you, I'm no bidding the job. I'll have no guaranteed yield. I'll have a tolerable yield problem with such an extremely severe standing wave ratio requirement. You'd be amazed how many places where an antenna with that lower standing wave ratio will make a piece of electronics behave extremely well compared to not doing it. The average person thinks that 2 to 1 or 1.5 to 1 standing wave ratio is good enough because of efficiency of forward transmission. That's only half the problem. That reflected energy on the antenna on certain kinds of electronics will give you a huge disadvantage. A moon bounce array is one of them. If you make your antenna 1.1 to 1 standing wave ratio or better, you'll get a hell of a lot of performance, a lot more performance out of your low noise amplifier when you're doing moon bounce. Not many amateurs have realized that yet, that low noise amplifier, you've carefully tuned it to half a dB noise figure on a purely 50 ohm piece of laboratory instrumentation called an automatic noise figure indicator. Let me drop. And so this antenna that's got a very careful tuning to give you that exotic noise figure, only when it sees 50 ohms resistance, which is a, let me pick a number, it's a 1.1 or better standing wave ratio, and you connect it to your real antenna, which has got 2 to 1, and you calculate that, all right, the forward gain is down half a dB because of the 2 to 1. Well, that half dB noise figure of your low noise preamplifier might degrade to 1.5 dB, and that'll definitely make the difference between a QSO and a non-QSO when it comes to a weak moonbound signal. So there's a whole art and science of benefit and techniques to be explored when it comes to extremely low standing wave ratio antennas. That's a whole area that has not been properly investigated, and a number of the patents that I've been involved in as a co-patenter are exploiting these techniques. And you can make some beautiful commercial products out of that once you understand what's going on. And the schools teach none of that about antennas. In most of the electrical engineering schools, antennas are barely mentioned during the last 2 weeks of the senior year. And so even though the students are being studying all kinds of electromagnetic theory and Smith chart and all kinds of circuits that use RF energy, but all of that RF energy is useless if it didn't get connected to an antenna, and the antennas are not covered in the curriculum. What's wrong with that picture? And as such, the majority of companies in the United States that need an antenna are outsourcing it. They don't have that talent in-house. In many cases, they don't think they've got the talent in-country, and they're outsourcing to other countries to do the antenna designs. Doesn't have to be that way, but inadvertently, that seems to be what is going on. Okay, do you think there's any other questions in the mailbag that we should cover for tonight, or do you think we've done enough mail? That's your choice. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KY. I'll just have a couple here that I'm just going to read off. Last week we discussed, if you remember, in detail. crank-up towers. And I got a number of comments here about crank-up towers, and they said that they are a problem child. If you're, like you say, going to continuously crank them up and down, you are going to have failures, major failures, with the antenna, with the towers. And in fact, I got a comment from a person here that's in a professional tower installation, and he said there's only one of the commercial towers that is available that has a really well-designed system for going up and down based on more like an elevator system. And he says the only one that he can really recommend if you're going to go for a tower that if you, you know, insist that it has to be cranked up and down at a very regular situation where, you know, I just say you want to raise and lower it only as you use it daily or something like that, that he doesn't recommend the regular tower. There's only one or two that are manufactured specifically for that type of operation. So he says other than that, to be very aware of the crank-up towers, a failure rate is very high if they're not particularly used correctly. Over.
KC2YMP.
I think I heard KC2YMP, and we'll get to you in a second, sir. I'm strongly in agreement with that one, Mel. Now, bear in mind that I'm a biased guy. All of my years of tower work, which began in 1969, have been with self-standing, with the towers that are always standing up, held up with guy wires. So I'm strongly in favor of good, strong towers with lots of guy wires. And I'm not in favor of huge blocks of concrete below the tower as to the base. It's not as a bigger requirement. The guy wires are much more important. And so with the right kind of climbing safety harness on you and hardline cables going up the tower, I think I get more performance out of a non-crank-up tower. Now, the crank-up towers that I have seen, almost all of them have a winch mechanism that starts rusting pretty fast. The hauling up cable itself, at best, is stainless steel, but it has various wear mechanisms. But the very first pulley and some of the other pulleys that the winch rising cable goes over are usually without wheel ball bearings. In other words, there's a steel pulley operating on a steel shaft, and each time that steel pulley is being turned on that shaft with very high forces on that that stainless steel wire, you're wearing through that shaft. So if you haul up that that crank-up tower every single day, you're eventually going to wear through that shaft, the pulley's going to let loose, and terrible things can happen. There's lots of failure mechanisms of crank-up towers. A really well-constructed tower with weatherproof... Let me drop it. With weatherproofed ball bearings on each of those pulleys, and a really well-designed winch mechanism that doesn't have various failure mechanisms that'll let the tower start coming down in a hurry, the right kind of latching, anti-rust device, a haul-up cable that is very well overrated and doesn't start rusting and going into various failure modes. A well-designed crank-up tower with all of these characteristics and also some other kind of mechanism so that the sections that slide inside of each other are not chipping away at the galvanizing. In order to avoid all of these problems, the crank-up tower would be quite expensive, and the average guy buying a crank-up tower says, gee, I get 50 feet with this brand name for that number of dollars, I get 70 feet with that brand name for that number of dollars, and they usually use their pocketbook for doing most of the selecting, as opposed to digging into these details as to the failure mechanism. So my recommendation is go slow on a crank-up tower, because on paper and in your mind, if you don't have any of these details involved in your head, you think it's a cure-all solution. And I'm not so convinced that it is. There's a lot more to it than first meets the eye. Okay, the new person signing in, it sounded like Kilo Charlie to Yankee Mike Papa. I may have you wrong. Please start off with your name and tell me the correction on your call letters. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Kilo Charlie to Yankee Mike. That was correct. My name is Ralph from Largemont, New York. But just to enjoy a discussion about recent college graduates, I'm self-taught as of 2008.
out of about 60% of the time and very low audio. I got the fact that your call letters are correct, your name is Ralph, you're in Larchmont, and there's something about 2,000 feet. So give us a lot more audio, and if you have any way of increasing your RF, that would be helpful. Back to you, Ralph. KC2 Yankee Mike Papa, K2RIW.
I apologize. I'm only on a 5-watt handheld, so I have no way of power.
Space, a couple of orbits, to show that they can maneuver this thing rockets, and they have retro rockets, and they brought it back down through the atmosphere, similar to the old Mercury and Gemini and Apollo launches. It had an ablative shield on it to get rid of the heat. Landed successfully where they expected it to, in the Pacific, not too far from Mexico, about 500 miles out. Let me drop it. So with the success of this flight, they expected to have at least two more demonstration flights after it. NASA, they're trying to talk NASA, and NASA looks like it's willing to, what I read, go along with that, only one more demonstration flight. And then with that, they would be able to have cargo from the United States being delivered instead of using the Progress Russian cargo ships or the from the European Space Agency or the spacecraft from Japan. We'll be able to use that, but we'll be able to have our own, so it's a private company. So that was the launch, and it went off well, and maybe 5 years down the road, they'll put astronauts on. Designing the Dragon spacecraft to convert to be able to put up to seven astronauts on board and bring them up to the space station. Looks kind of tight though in the drawing. Back to your deck, WS1.
So your prediction, if I understand correctly, Paul, is that this private company, SpaceX, with the Dragon Falcon 9 spacecraft, you're saying it's going to be a number of years before they're approved for either bringing cargo or astronauts. Is that what I'm hearing? In other words, we're going to be dependent on either an extension of the shuttle program, which doesn't look so likely, or only the Russian Progress and the Russian Soyuz, I guess it is, spacecraft, are the only way that you know of to transport astronauts and cosmonauts up to and down from the International Space Station. So I think you're saying it's going to be a number of years before this private company will have full approval. Is that approximately true, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah, well, right now they have a billion and a half contract to put up a half a dozen Progress-like missions, cargo resupply missions. And that will be extended, if, you know, once they get going. And this will probably be, you know, every three or four months they'll be having a launch. 5 years down the road, of course, that would be a completely different contract with NASA. You know, once the cargo thing went well, they would hopefully approve them to go ahead with building a spacecraft. I think it's going to go that way. I mean, it's a push for it. Looking at 5 years before that would come to fruition. That's been asked to develop the spacecraft 5 years. But yeah, that's you know, they do have a lot of help. It was launched from 40 on far out from the Cape Kennedy. And they use the same launch system that they used for the Atlas mission that they tested at NASA out on the Atlas in their Gary truck, which is in the grass. 300-foot lightning towers that are infrastructure. NASA had it on their website when it went up, and the news stations carried it. Didn't know when it was going to go up exactly because of the delay, so I just recorded a long amount of hours during that day, and the next day as things I wanted. Put them together on one disc. So, well, eventually here. The disc of previous flights, I'd like to have one or two discs. Now, commercial flights.
And the fact that you're hearing it to the north is a bit unusual.
quite often I would hear it to the southwest. In other words, Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, they would start coming through like they're in my backyard. KC2 QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, very good, Dick. We actually had a station come in this morning on this repeater. That I would say somewhere like right around noontime or a little bit after that, that basically was on a 5-watt HT in upstate New York inside their house. at that point, I was like, and I was looking at the repeater strength on my S-meter when I was pointed towards the repeater, which is really west of me, and it was only the repeater strength, which is normally 25, 40 over, was only reading S5. And I swung the beam around to north, and it came back up to where it would normally be. I had to go outside to look at the antenna to see that my antenna didn't break in its mount and is pointing in the wrong direction. No, it's pointing the right way. And oddly enough, it's like almost everything on this band is favoring north from my location. So I just suggest if somebody has a beam tonight and they're having difficulty coming in, maybe just point the beam, move it around a little bit and see where the stronger direction is. But I would bet more than likely it's probably north is going to be what does it for tonight. Back over to you, Dick. Just wanted to give you a little update of something I noticed today. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
Yeah, in another 30 seconds, I'm going to turn it over to Alan for his report on what he's seeing. On the 432 band, on a number of occasions, I'd be listening to a signal that's in the Philadelphia area, which is roughly 240 degrees from me, southwest, and because of some kind of a crazy weather condition, I could aim my antenna to the northwest, almost 90 degrees away, and get a stronger signal off a reflection off some kind of a cloud. And there were times where I would aim the antenna midway between the two, and I would be hearing the signal, in the side lobes of the antenna from both locations simultaneously, but one was much more delayed in time. And therefore, you had a funny echoey sound to the single sideband voice the guy was giving me. And for signal to become that directive on the 70-centimeter band was kind of unusual. I wonder what kind of a Yagi you're possibly using, or an aimable antenna, Alan, and what are you hearing? KC2RFN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Dick, I'm just using an 8-foot vertical, I think it's a diamond I got up there on the roof, and that's it. But I think Glenn is referring to the conversation I had with the same fellow you just had a conversation with up in Larchmont. When he called this afternoon, I was talking to him, and he had a very good signal. When he said he was from Larchmont, I said I knew that was well up north by New Rochelle or so. It's like, wow, he's coming in really well into this repeater. I mean, it's full quietic. And I had asked him what he had on the roof, and he said he just, I was his first contact on 2 meters, and he was doing it with a handheld 5-watt walkie-talkie. And I wonder if now he's not coming in so well because conditions changed, or maybe the battery on his HT is beginning to wear down. But that's KC2YMP, who you were just speaking with right now. Now you can barely copy him, but before he was banging in almost like you are, Dick.
I understand, Alan, and it's too bad that Ralph was not coming through at the time he wanted to. The battery being weak is very unlikely. The way most handy talkies work, the phase lock loop system will turn itself off when you go below a certain voltage on the battery. And a fully charged battery where a battery is about to die, the difference in power output is either 5 watts versus 2.5 or 3 watts. And that's only a 3 dB change. With rare exception, that doesn't make the difference between a QSO and a non-QSO. Ralph would like his signal to be 20 decibels stronger tonight. Not 3 dB stronger, if you know what I mean. So the battery is not the explanation. His handy-talkie wasn't dropping out, and I don't think that's it. It's a minor effect. I guess a little bit later on, or maybe just right now, we'll give Ralph another try if he wants to do it. When you study single sideband signals where everybody is using an S-meter, and on FM we almost never do. Let me drop. And also on single sideband, you tend to talk to guys 50, 100, 150, 200 miles away, whereas on FM we tend to talk to people very local. So the sideband people who are always monitoring their S-meter see huge differences in signal strength from day to day and season to season. And that's Mother Nature's atmosphere for you. The super refraction or sub-refraction. You can also get sub-refraction. In other words, the more moist layer of air can be up high and the dry air down low, and that creates an upward bending of the signal, the opposite of following Earth curvature. So the guy that you think you've got line of sight to, because you're on top of a high hill, and he's only 50 miles away, and he's at reasonable land, and ordinarily you get a signal of him 30 dB out of the noise, and tonight you can't hear him at all. That's the subrefraction phenomena. And Mother Nature will do that also to you. Propagation is a great thing to study. But when it comes to precipitation static, when I used to have my 432 Yagi on the top of my 100-foot tower at this location on a 300 feet above sea level piece of land, the 432 Yagi would pick up lightning static and precipitation static. There were a number of days during the year, particularly in February, where during a snowstorm, I would hear some very loud, raspy sound coming out of my receiver because of the corona discharge taking place on the Yagi antenna itself. Let me drop. At a later time, when I made sure that there was another 5 feet of mast or 10 feet of mast sticking out of the tower above the Yagi, which now took the corona discharge of the atmosphere, 99% of all of that noise on the Yagi elements disappeared. Although it wouldn't be easy, if this repeater had a pole, a metallic pole, in the vicinity of this antenna that went a little bit higher than this antenna, and the pole experienced the corona discharge as opposed to the station master itself, the majority of the static we're hearing right now would disappear. The worst example I saw of that was a product that was manufactured way back in 20 years ago or so at Airborne Instruments Laboratory. Was a very elaborate antenna that was part of a military communication system, and the antenna was mounted on a granite mountain somewhere in Scandinavia. The antenna had a radome that was about 12 or 14 inches in diameter, a fiberglass radome, 20 feet tall. Inside there was a VHF, low-frequency VHF, I think it was like a 150 megacycle antenna, collinear antenna mounted inside of there, made out of very heavy brass material. Well, the lightning that happens in the wintertime on top of that Scandinavian mountain will sometimes strike that antenna, blast at a great big hole in the side of the fiberglass radome, and damage the living daylights out of the brass antenna inside. Let me drop. And each time this failure occurred, the company would repair the antenna and say it was a freak accident, put it all back together and send it again, and 6 months or a year later, the problem would repeat it. And I tried talking people into mounting another tower alongside of the antenna with the radome that would take the hit. Because it's very very difficult on the top of a granite mountain to get a good ground. You're going to be hit with lightning periodically. So you can decide whether your antenna is going to be hit or a metallic structure you put alongside. The metallic structure alongside would be inexpensive, and it would solve the problem 99% of the time. Everyone at the factory thought that was a crazy idea. They just tried beefing up the antenna. Well, no matter how much they beefs up the antenna, when it's struck with one of those super positive polarity lightning bolts that they get in Scandinavia, which is going to hit you with 100,000 amperes, no matter what in the world the antenna is made out of, your brass elements of the antenna are going to be blasted. And they were. They were melted down time after time. So if you keep doing what you've always done, you'll keep getting what you've always got. I wasn't able to convince anyone of that particular philosophy. And they weren't willing to change or admit that there was a potential error in the philosophy of how the antenna was being used. Lightning is strange stuff, but some of the things that lightning does are predictable. One more drop. You guys have heard the story a number of times where on top of my 100-foot tower, one time I was fixing a 7/8 inch diameter coaxial cable. I had the connector off the top of it, and I'm realizing that the snow had just started. And it was a not super heavy snow, but great big snowflakes. I've got a safety belt on. I'm on a pretty secure tower. I wasn't very worried about it. And pretty soon I realized the snowflakes were slapping me in the back of the head. I said, gee, that's strange. How in the world can snowflakes be slapping me in the back of the head so hard that I can feel them hitting my head? And I soon realized that the tips of the antennas that I was standing very near all had a purple glow on them. So there was a high voltage discharge taking place during the snowstorm on the top of the tower. And I didn't dwell there very long. I knew that there's a high probability a lightning bolt was coming along, and quite possibly I was near the highest structure around, and it was going to strike me. I didn't even bother putting the connector back on the cable. I didn't worry about snow going down the cable. I got out of there in a hurry. So in the wintertime, you can get some pretty high voltages built up. The people in Toronto, Canada, will hear thunder and lightning during their thunderstorms in the wintertime very frequently. I was there in Toronto on a couple of, I said Toronto, Ottawa. No, it was Toronto. I was in Toronto. Here we go. Montreal. I was in Montreal, which they get lake effect lightning storms very frequently in the wintertime, and boy, do they hear a lot of thunder and lightning. So although it's normally a summertime phenomenon, on rare occasions it happens in the wintertime, and tonight's one of those. And with any further questions or comments, before we go over to the deeper questions, give me your call letters right now, K2RIW and the Tech Man.
K2KEY.
Go ahead, Mel.
I notice on HF many times I find the, which way the band is open. For instance, you know, if I rotate the beam around to where the so-called background noise starts to come up, usually then if you call CQ, there's a good chance you're going to get a band from that direction. It seems like it always works. If you rotate that beam around and the background noise is constant, it's no band opening. If it is in one particular direction, it seems like that in that direction, there's a band opening. So what are we actually listening to? Is that some kind of a atmospheric anomaly, or is that some kind of a something that is taking place more or less in the distance, Dick, over.
You're much more of an HF operator than I am, Mel, so I'm going to give you speculation based on my VHF experience. We've all read the fact that there are thousands and thousands of thunderstorms going on around the world significantly, continuously. No matter where you stand in the world, somewhere there is an HF thunderstorm within HF propagation of you. When you aim your antenna in the direction where you're hearing more than normal amount of noise, because as long as I go a great enough number of miles, let's assume now that I'm always aiming my antenna in every possible compass direction, and my antenna, by some magic, has the ability to listen to signals that are 15,000 miles away, 10,000 miles away. So in every compass direction, I'm going to be listening to the noise over the 10,000 miles of that particular compass heading. And if within that particular compass heading, within that 10,000 miles, there are thunderstorms, and there almost always are, the thunderstorms, no matter what compass heading I go, if I'm always going 10,000 miles, I'm always going to be hitting thunderstorms. I'm going to make a rough guess because of the usual distribution of thunderstorms around planet Earth. Therefore, when I aim in that particular direction and I hear the thunderstorm louder, which will show up as background noise, then I know I've got good HF propagation to my particular antenna with its antenna height, which has a certain takeoff angle. The ionosphere is favoring the propagation in that direction, obvious by the fact that I'm hearing more lightning noise in that direction. What you hear as background noise, I'm saying it's something that Mother Nature is doing with thunderstorms in that direction. So therefore, the noisier direction has better propagation to your particular antenna and this particular polarization. Therefore, you're more likely to get an answer to a QSO in that direction. That's a guess on my part, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Well, then we're assuming that there's a thunderstorm in that direction. Maybe, possible, but, you know, it's hard to say that there's always a thunderstorm, but maybe somewhere in that direction could be a thunderstorm. Yeah, I guess maybe that could be an answer to it. You know, it's hard to believe that there's always a thunderstorm that is creating that effect. But it just seems like at times that it's like a situation that it seems to be always, you know, when the bands, only when the bands, I should say, are dead, that you get this effect, that you can turn your beam and look for that. When the band, the propagation is good, you don't hear that effect, to say the least, Dick. Over.
Okay, let me momentarily relate this to the deep field and ultra-deep field picture that was done by the Hubble Space Telescope. You and I go out in the backyard at night with dark-adapted eyes. We look in certain directions, we see stars. In other directions, it looks pretty dark, even on a clear night. But there is no starless direction. You take approximately a 1 degree beamwidth telescope called Hubble. You aim it in some particular direction that you think is blank, and you integrate that picture for a million seconds. Out comes the ultra deep field picture, which has got zillions of stars and 2,600 galaxies that you've never seen before. What I'm getting at is whether you're looking with a narrow beamwidth in one particular direction at the sky, or you're looking with your particular antenna, your tunable antenna, your turnable antenna, in some particular direction, because of the scattering of thousands and thousands of thunderstorms around the Earth, no matter what direction you aim your antenna, in that direction, it's always going to hit a thunderstorm. Let me drop. Because there's thousands and thousands of thunderstorms somewhat randomly scattered around the surface of this Earth, some of them over the water, some of them over land, whatever, but in every direction, your beam, if you go far enough in that direction, you're going to hit a thunderstorm. So there is no direction you can aim your antenna where there is no thunderstorm in that direction. In some cases, it may look like a long path to the thunderstorm, but you're always going to hit a thunderstorm. As such, the only thing that determines not whether or not you're going to hit a thunderstorm, there's always a thunderstorm in that direction, no matter what the direction is. The only thing to remain to discuss is what is the propagation in that direction. Do you have enough ionospheric propagation, the right bounces and the right angles, so that you have a thunderstorm in the range of the propagation, because there's always a thunderstorm out there. Just a matter of, do you have propagation to the range of that thunderstorm? Once you have a quiet band and it's noisy in some particular direction, that's proving you've got propagation in that direction where there's always a thunderstorm. If you've got propagation, then a guy out there is going to give you an answer. That's a guess on my part, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Yeah, I guess it's not out, like you said, like at least 1,000 thunderstorms on the Earth, somewhere on the Earth. Most likely be able to pick up one somewhere. The point is, I could say, it seems like when the propagation is good, you don't hear it. You never hear that effect, that, you know, because I guess good propagation maybe overrides. Because you remember, the noise that you pick up when rotating the beam is very, very weak. It's weak noise. It's not a predominant, you know, banging away like the UFO with a local thunderstorm. It's a noise that, I can't even say it's a static noise like you would expect from thunder activity. It's just like a constant hit that just stays constant, but peak down, and that's why you're able to peak it, because that hit is there, you know, constant, higher than in that direction than any other direction. So it's not, like I say, not a snapping type of noise. It's a constant hissing noise, like a discharge, a constant discharge, you know, of a spark, but evenly over.
Now, Carl Jansky in 1932, working for Bell Laboratories at Homedale, New Jersey, was asked to find out on the 15 megacycle band where all that noise was coming from. And he built this Sturber curtain rotatable antenna, and he found out the center of the galaxy does make noise. That's one kind of hissing noise, but I don't think you're running into that very often. When a thunderstorm is 20 miles or 50 miles away from you, you hear individual static crashes. When that thunderstorm is 10,000 miles away from you, and in that direction, you're looking at 25 thunderstorms at once at various ranges and slightly different azimuths, and you put all of those individual static crashes together, you don't hear individual crashes anymore. There's so many happening every second that it becomes essentially a hiss. So I think the majority of the noise that you're hearing is Mother Nature's weather. It is high voltage, lightning-like, and other kinds of corona discharge from thunderstorms and similar storms is what you're hearing in that direction. And there's so many of them at that great range where the band is open that you're no longer hearing individual crashes like you would with a local storm. So I think weather noise is what you're hearing 90-some-odd percent of the time when you hear that hiss in the background. Now, the noise from the center of the galaxy, although Jansky measured it, it required an extremely high gain antenna aimed at the center of the galaxy to get it. It's a rather weak signal, only detectable in direction when you have a very high gain antenna. So the majority of the noise you're hearing, I believe, is weather-related, not space-related. And again, the hiss is because so many thunderstorms are crashing simultaneously that it all blends into one great big hiss. That's another guess on my part.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
K2KEY, K2LIW.
I would agree, but it's only on DX. As you said, it's thousands of miles away. So it's only, you know, you'll find long past really deep. I had the experience a few weeks ago, maybe a month ago, there was a station operating on 15 meters, and I thought I'd never catch this guy, operating right off the island, Kermadec Island, that's right off New Zealand, and on 15 meters, the band conditions were dead. I didn't expect to hear it, and somebody had said that some kind of strange current every day around 4 o'clock in the afternoon, 4:30 in the afternoon, they hear them, and they came to heaven. One of the locals said, "Do try to work. You know, you need a little better antenna set up." And I said, "I'll give them a listen to it." And sure enough, I hear them. Z8 out of text out of Kermadec Island in near New Zealand on 15 meters, 21 megahertz. Nothing else on the band. I rotated that beam, and I guess I could see no difference from the long path, the short path, and all. But I gave him a call. I was running, you know, kilowatt. Gave him a call. He came back. Gave me a report. The signal was really breaking down. But I was so amazed that why at a certain time, a certain place, nothing else to do it on the entire band. And I don't think there's been another opening. So. You know, it's so hard to explain these crazy situations that show up, Dick. There's no real definite answer or some prediction you can do.
I'm guessing that the great circle path between you and that guy off of New Zealand is a healthy 11,000, 12,000 miles. Man alive, there's a lot of area in there. Wow. Assuming you're using a beam, rotatable beam with, I'm going to pick a number, a 50-degree beam width, 40-degree beam width to it. If I take a 40-degree beam width and plot it on my globe and then wrap it all the way around the globe to that 11,000-mile range to that New Zealand station, that total beam width of your antenna wrapped on that globe, I wouldn't be a bit surprised to find out it's taking up one quarter of the area of the Earth's mill. Can you imagine the number of thunderstorms, not only the number of thunderstorms, but you've got, let me pick a number, 50 individual clouds ready to give lightning in each individual storm, and you probably have hundreds of thunderstorms simultaneously in that great big swath of area that you're wrapping around the Earth, and any one of those thunderstorms in that area. Now I'm going to speculate reflecting medium. I'm not going to have a good one on that one. When it comes to reflecting signals off of thunderclouds, I've personally done that. And on 10 gigs, it works like a charm. You get down to a frequency like 21 megacycles, 15 meters now. the amount of radar cross-section you get off of a thundercloud is much too small. You do get a nice burst of signal off of the lightning bolt itself, off of that ionized path, but that path only keeps the right amount of ionization for some number of milliseconds. That keeps you the crash of noise and the burst of signal, but the noise you're getting is from all of those thunderclouds, is my guess, and lots of them in that tremendous amount of area you're covering. And the fact that you're hearing a lot of noise in that area says you've got good ionospheric pop.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You've got good ionospheric propagation in that area, therefore you stand a greater chance of hearing him. And how does one little guy, well, New Zealand has got a nice maritime environment around it as such. And by the way, he's in his summertime right now, Mel. He's at the height of his summer. So he's got a lot of nice, warm, moist water all around him, and nice trade winds, all kinds of churning of moisture in that atmosphere. So his local propagation to launch that signal couldn't be better. He's getting the best the best possible forward-propagated tropospheric scatter propagation on planet Earth. He's in the most ideal place on the world to launch that signal. And once you launch that signal through that very desirable atmospheric condition, and the first 500 miles, it's primarily over water before it gets to your QTH, that gives him a zillion ways of getting that signal into Manhattan Beach, Brooklyn. K2KEY, K2LIW.
KC2QAQ with a comment?
Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, I've experienced a lot of what Mel has on HF bands where, you know, there's times, I guess, where the background noise, when I look at the noise floor, and just by spinning the antenna around, I will notice that it looks like the ionosphere is actually, because it's not static crashes, it's just, if you watch the S-meter in the background as you move the antenna around, there's certain directions that you'll see the S-meter, the noise floor definitely is definitely higher in those directions. And, you know, typically if I put out a CQ into that noisy area, I usually stand a much better chance of getting some kind of DX back. And, you know, there again, it's different on different bands, too. So, in other words, just because that direction is the noisy, high noise floor on 15 meters doesn't mean it's going to be the same on 20. But I guess that's just the properties of the ionosphere and how it works. But a lot of times, you know, pointing in the noisy direction is usually where the DX is. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I believe it. Now, when it comes to long-range propagation, the rays of the S-meter and that hiss noise that you hear, I believe is individual static crashes, but there's so many of them, they blend. When I used to get there in the wintertime on my 432 Yagi, when it didn't have mast sticking out of the top of the tower, and I would hear high voltage buildup coming out of the 432 receiver, I would hear click, 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 click. The clicks got faster and faster. They eventually rose to a high-pitched, very raspy note, and occasionally they would go into a higher pitch yet where I would no longer hear the tone. It would sound like broadband noise. And then it would abruptly stop, and 60 seconds later, the cycle would repeat. On a couple of occasions, I turned the little audio up real loud out of the receiver. I'd walk out the backyard, look up at the top of the tower at nighttime, and I'm hearing this high-pitched sound getting noisier and noisier out of the receiver. I'm looking up at the top of the tower, and all of a sudden, I see a bright purple flash that gets burned into my eye, hits the top of the tower, almost no sound, and all of a sudden, the high-pitched noise coming out of the receiver disappears. In other words, an extremely small lightning bolt, so to speak, corona discharge occurred at the top of the tower, and the cycle would repeat. The bottom line of all this is that when you get individual status crashes or individual corona discharges, when the number gets high enough, because you've got so darn many square miles you're looking at, so darn many thunderstorms, it becomes broadband.